Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, the non-DOJ-approved Standard 2 guest today. Eric Blank will tell us about worker-led union organizing, and Molly O'Neill will review the recent elections in Germany, which saw the far-right AfD make a strong showing. Traditional union organizing, that is the kind done by professional organizers, has not been racking up the successes lately, and by lately I mean for several decades. Last year, just 5.9% of private sector workers were members of unions, less than half the share of 1990, and a quarter the share of 1974. It's hard to imagine how the working class could have more prosperous and secure lives without reversing that slide. New models are clearly necessary, and my first guest, Eric Blank, a scholar, journalist, and activist who specializes in unions, is here to talk about them. Eric, an assistant professor of labor studies at Rutgers, is just out with a book, We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big, from the University of California Press. His previous book, Red State Revolt, was a look at the teacher uprisings in West Virginia and other states. He was on the show to discuss it when it came out in 2019. This one is a study of worker-led organizing efforts, like those at Starbucks and Amazon, that have shown remarkable energy and even some success in a time when labor's story is mostly a catalog of defeats. The strategy is also informing more traditional unions, like the UAW under President Sean Fain, in their successful strike against the auto industry in 2023. And we're seeing it now in the resistance federal workers have shown to Trump's attempts to decimate the government workforce. Eric Blank. There have been some, and I think I've talked to you about this in the past, there have been great changes in the spatial layout of American life since the great labor upsurge of the 1930s. Then we had dense urban areas where workers lived together, socialized together, had all these networks of solidarity. Now we have dispersed suburban configurations, much more atomized social structures. What does this do to organizing and to worker consciousness?
The short version is that it makes organizing harder. The reality is the working class is much more atomized, as you mentioned, than it was 100 years ago. And so this poses real challenges to organizing at scale. Essentially, my book is an attempt to ask and answer what would it take to organize tens of millions of workers in our contemporary political economic context. And it's harder, than it was 100 years ago. It doesn't mean it's less necessary. I think it's actually just as necessary if we're going to reverse inequality, avoid climate catastrophe, overcome the growth of the far right. So the necessity for organizing millions of people into unions is just as high. But what do you do when workers don't go to the same churches like they used to, when they don't socialize at the same bars like they used to? It means that the existing social relationships between workers are much thinner, and organizers have to spend a lot more time fostering those relationships. And in turn, when you win a union election, it's less likely to organically spread just via word of mouth, via pre-existing networks. You have to be much more proactive than you used to be as far as spreading it. So the level of fostering necessary for organizing at scale is much higher than it was a century ago.
Everyone wants to reproduce the great moments of the 1930s when union density really took off. Talk for a moment how that happened.
Yeah, so, the 1930s was the one major breakthrough in the private sector for American workers, in which union density more than doubled, and in which you had the breakthrough of unionization into the big mass production industries, auto, steel, coal. The drive and campaign was very bottom-up. So I go into some of the numbers of this in the book. We have data on how many staffers, for instance, that they had in the most top-down campaign of the era. So just to give you an example of how much things have changed, the Steelworkers Organizing Committee was, this was like the most top-down, most staffed-up campaign of the era, and they had about one staffer for every 2,000 workers that they wanted to organize. Today, the norm is that you have one staffer for every 100 workers you're trying to organize. So it just gives you a dramatic sense of, even at the time, the most staff-intensive campaign was extremely worker-led by today's standards. And so, yeah, the dynamic really was driven from below. Workers self-organized. They got support from organizers and unions, but it was much more minimal than something that you would experience today.
What changed? Are the employers more hostile? The atomization that we were talking about earlier?
Yeah, a lot of things happened. Part of it is these political economic shifts made the pre-existing social ties weaker. A big part of it was the radicals were kicked out of the labor movement in the 1950s, so much of the role of radicals was to act in a way not dissimilar to the way maybe a good full-time union staffer might organize today, which is that the radicals were out there taking the initiative. They were spending all of their waking hours trying to agitate their coworkers and beating their heads against the walls against the billionaires, or, you know, maybe they were millionaires at the time. So the radicals that really led these movements were primarily worker leaders, and they got kicked out of the labor movement in the 50s under McCarthyism. And so you had the growth of business unionism, and unions, frankly, sort of accommodated themselves to the status quo, and that in turn left them woefully unprepared when the status quo turned on them from the 80s onwards. And we're still reaping the consequences of that. Labor hasn't recovered from Reaganism and deindustrialization, and it means that now, you know, union density has plummeted to 6% in the private sector, and we're almost back to square one.
And the public sector is not doing much better lately. The industrial structures have also changed. GM and, you know, the big auto companies had concentrated factories, whereas now we're looking at thousands of stores for, say, retailers and food service like Starbucks.
Right. And so, you know, it was actually not very hard if you were a radical in the 1930s to know where you should concentrate your energies. There actually wasn't even much of a debate. It was sort of obvious that you should go to the biggest factory nearby. Right? Like that's where you would go. And a decent chance you might already work there because so many of your coworkers already work there. Today, that's just not the case. There aren't these same centrally located massive workplaces around which communities revolve. There are still important targets. I don't think that we should dismiss the utility of targeting particular workplaces, targeting particular companies. There's still a role for that. But it's just not the case that there's these sort of as central nodal points to the economy, as central choke points that there used to be. And so this requires a type of organizing that is much broader in scale and much more diffuse in its targets than was necessary or possible 100 years ago.
Are workers today, or how many workers today, are aware of the possibility of even forming a union?
Yeah, it's a great question. This is one of the things that comes up a lot when you interview workers is they say, well, you know, I didn't even know you could form a union. I thought that unions were just for coal miners, or there's union jobs, there's non-union jobs, right? So the idea that a union is just something that is formed by workers up until recently was very rarely understood. That started to change now because of these high-profile unionization drives that were very clearly bottom-up. So Starbucks, Amazon, these got a lot of press and went viral on social media. And that raises the idea to people that, oh, I guess I could just do what they did. I could just organize my workplace. No one's going to come and do it for me. But even today, after all of these efforts, I think that millions and millions of workers still don't realize that they could take the lead in organizing their workplace.
Okay, let's talk about the two models, staff organizers versus worker organizers. Describe what each is about and what the differences are and where each might be appropriate.
In the book, I talk about two major contrasts, as you mentioned. One is staff-intensive organizing, and the other is worker-to-worker organizing. Staff-intensive organizing is a catch-all term I came up with, essentially to talk about all of the different forms of unionization that are very heavily reliant on staffers. And this has been the norm in a kind of a variety of colors up until very recently. As I mentioned, the norm in the unionization drive really since the 1980s is you need best practices, one staffer for every 100 workers you're targeting. And this type of organizing actually at its best can be extremely effective. I'm not arguing in the book against the importance of staffers or against the importance of resources, or even saying that this type of model can't win. It can win. The problem is it can't win widely enough. There's just not enough money and there's not enough time to organize tens of millions of workers through this type of staff-intensive model. So my argument in the book is you need a new model that can replicate the best aspects of this tradition, but to do it in a way that is scalable. And so what worker-to-worker organizing does is essentially it gives the responsibilities of staffers, many of them to worker leaders. And so listeners can think in their head, you know, what does this look like? Well, it looks like the Starbucks workers campaign. It looks like a lot of the Amazon organizing, the auto workers drive all across the South, the News Guild organizing in journalism, a lot of the higher ed drives. These have been efforts in which workers have done key tasks that are normally done by staffers. So specifically, one, training other workers. In a staff-intensive campaign, normally it's a full-timer who's going to be doing the intensive training and coaching of the workers who are trying to organize their shop. Here, it tends to be workers are doing that. So Starbucks, they won a union election in Buffalo in late 2021. Hundreds and then thousands of baristas all across the country reached out to them. And if they had been a staff-intensive campaign, there's just no way they would have been able to go viral. And, you know, most unions, frankly, wouldn't have even tried to go national because they would have stuck with the old model. But instead, they said, okay, we're going to have the workers themselves who won their union election in these shops in Buffalo jump on a Zoom call and talk through how they won together with their coworkers nationwide. So this worker training other worker dynamic is central to a lot of these drives. So is the idea that workers can self-initiate their organizing even before they affiliate with a union. So many of these drives began as workers doing the basic organizing tasks that they maybe learned by reading a Labor Notes article or reading Jane McAlevey or looking online, finding out what do you do? How do you start a union? Workers have tended to do these first steps on their own and then connect with a union. And so this really changes the dynamic, A, because you don't need staff for much of the drive because workers are leading it on their own at first. But then also once union organizing committees affiliate with a union, then the relationship with it, an established union, tends to be more of a partnership than a relationship of deference, which is the problem that you have in a lot of more staff-intensive drives. So workers self-organize, then connect with the union rather than sort of being affiliated from the start. And then the last point that distinguishes the model is that workers are making strategy, oftentimes together with full-time staffers, but they're in these meetings, they're in the driver's seat, figuring out what to do, not just on this or that tactical thing of where do you pass out a flyer, but on all of the big questions of the campaign, its politics, its major decisions. Oftentimes in staff-intensive drives, it's tends to fall on the full-time staffers to come up with the big strategic decisions. And here, workers are at that table as well.
Given the expense and complexity of the staff model of organizing, does it even make sense in narrowly economic terms for unions to put a lot into that sort of organizing, even if not organizing means eventual extinction?
Yeah, it's a good question. Part of the argument in the book is that the existing model's exorbitant costs is one of the reasons you don't have unions doing as much new organizing as they should be. It doesn't explain everything, because frankly, a lot of unions aren't even trying. A lot of unions aren't even debating the best costs and all of this. Your average union these days is actually not even thinking about growth. But for those who are, yeah, the model of extreme staff intensivity costing upwards of $3,000 per worker you're trying to organize, yeah, it's not like a good return on investment to use that terminology. And that helps explain why so few unions are doing serious major investment in new organizing.
How does this worker-to-worker model differ from the approach of our late friend Jane McAlevey?
Jane's work is actually asking a different question. I don't see this as counterposed to the arguments that Jane made. Jane's core mission in life and core pedagogic argument was how to teach workers the tactics and methods to build power and win. My book mostly just agrees with those tactics and says, okay, well, how do you get enough workers to start organizing along those lines? And Jane, if anything, really is one of the major boosters of this type of bottom-up organizing, because if you think about what she did through her books and through her trainings like Organizing for Power, what she was doing was giving workers, even when they weren't in unions, the tools to start organizing with the best tools of the trade and the best methods. Yeah, she probably did more than anybody else in the country and in the world to help boost this bottom-up worker-to-worker organizing drive. What I'm talking about is not really arguing for new tactics. I'm arguing for a new model, sort of a new division of labor, so that these tactics can be more widely scaled up. So I see it as somewhat distinct and overlapping, but not contradictory with Jane's arguments.
I'm speaking with Eric Blank, author of We Are the Union. And how do these worker organizers learn the trade? Do they consult with each other? Is it online stuff? They read books? TikTok? How's it work?
It's a good question. I did a lot of interviews and I did a large-scale survey for the book. So the book is sort of deeply based on empirical research. I reached out to every drive that went public in 2022. Some of the patterns that emerged is a lot of workers learned these tools by reading Jane McAlevey, maybe attending a Jane McAlevey training. There was a good number of workers that read some of the Labor Notes materials. A lot of workers participated in a training or got support from EWOC, the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, which supports worker-led organizing. And there's a more general background condition, which is that a lot of these workers had some level of activist experience. A lot of people had been maybe voters for the Bernie campaign, maybe they volunteered and door knocked. So there was some sort of basic level of understanding that really what organizing is talking to other people, and a basic level understanding that anybody can do organizing. It's something that exists only sort of for the experts. And because of this radicalization essentially of young people that predates the union drive, a lot of that energy then got transformed and focused in on the workplace in a way that would have been hard to imagine maybe 20 years ago in the absence of this youth radicalization and the experience people had over multiple battles. And then also the digital tools piece, more general, I think, as you suggested, is important. It's just the information about how to organize is much more easily accessible now because you can look online, you can watch a video, you can sort of track it down if you need to in a way that honestly just was much harder when I was first sort of as like a young kid trying to organize. The available resources were much lower. So now if you're a self-starting worker, you want to figure out like how do you get started, well, it's not that hard to find that information online.
Starbucks, that really is one of the stars of this movement. It started at what, one store in Buffalo and then spread nationwide. So give us the outline of how that developed.
I do think it's probably the best case study we have for worker-worker organizing, not just because it spread so widely. You know, there's over 500 stores now that have unionized, but because they had to confront the worst union-busting campaign in sort of modern American history. You have to go back to the 1930s to see something as horrific as what this nominally liberal company did to its workers. Utter terrorization campaign, just blatant illegal act after illegal act. And nevertheless, the workers persisted. It's a long story, so I won't go into all of the detail, but they were initially going to just do a small regional campaign around organizing coffee in upstate New York. There was no plan to organize Starbucks nationally. It was late 2021, and when they went public with their drive, and particularly after they won Buffalo, won election, it got inundated with interest all across the country, and they jumped into it. It's pretty amazing when you talk to the workers about those early weeks is they didn't know what they were doing. They were building the plane as they flew it, but they knew that something was going on, and there was a huge amount of interest that was unanticipated all across the country, and they went for it. And they trusted workers all across the country to start self-organizing. Eventually, that bottom-up campaign got more support from Workers United, which was the national affiliate that initially supported the drives. And then eventually, although not immediately, SEIU, which is one of the biggest unions in the country, ended up providing serious resources to the campaign. And I think all of that's important. And it shows that really the sweet spot for organizing, if you're going to go up against one of the biggest corporations in the world, Starbucks is the sixth largest private employer, I believe, in the United States. If you're going to take on such powerful companies, you need to have some combination of this bottom-up worker-to-worker dynamic with serious resources. So I think Starbucks shows really how that can be combined. It's pretty unique and remarkable how they've been able to keep worker leadership, keep this militancy, while still participating in and getting the support from tactically conservative, massive union organizations. And there's tensions there. It's not easy. But the reason that they've gone as far as they did, and they've gone very far, they forced the company to the bargaining table. Unlike Amazon, for instance, which is just ignoring the existence of the union, Starbucks wants to settle. The question is, the workers don't want to settle for what the company is offering. The company is not offering a good enough wage increase, and workers are keeping on fighting because they want to get a first contract that's not just a first contract. They want a good first contract. And I would expect that over the coming weeks and months, they're going to win that.
Yeah, that's the problem. Like, we hear a lot about the initial victories, but using this model, can workers actually get a contract where they succeeded in organizing themselves?
Yeah, it's true that just winning a union election in the United States doesn't guarantee you a first contract. And in many ways, the hardest battle is around first contracts. But it's not the case, as a lot of skeptics have suggested, that there's something inherently limited in this model because they haven't won a first contract yet at Starbucks or Amazon. The reason they haven't is that these are massive companies. Most unions aren't even trying to organize them. And so the reason it takes longer against a big company is just it's a big, massive company that takes a lot of effort to organize enough workers to force them to the bargaining table. So if you look at the way this model has succeeded against the types of targets that traditional union organizing has also focused on, so hospitals, universities, smaller chains, well, actually, this model holds up just as well, if not better. They have won first contracts, for instance, all across journalism, which are very hard-fought battles because these are journalists going up against hedge fund-managed companies. And the News Guild, which has very explicitly a member-to-member organizing model, very similar to Starbucks, if anything, even more bottom-up, they've won hundreds of first contracts in the last 7 years. So it's just not the case that this model can't go all the way. The distinct question is, how do you go all the way against these massive companies? And the answer is, it just, you know, it takes a while, so you have to have a long-term strategic vision.
Could existing unions learn from this model? Is there some kind of possible hybrid that combines the grassroots techniques and the resources of a large union, or would that be death to the worker-worker model?
I would frame it differently. I mean, I actually argue that the worker-to-worker model at its best does require staff and does require significant amount of resources. So I don't actually see these as counterposed. I don't think it's just like worker-to-worker organizing on the one hand and staff union resources on the other. If you look at Starbucks Workers United, if you look at the News Guild, if you look at United Auto Workers, these are established unions that have found ways to use their resources and their support to boost up bottom-up worker-led organizing. And so, yeah, I think that those unions show not only the possibility, but the necessity for union resources to be put towards that type of model. And there's no reason other unions can't do it as well.
This movement derived a lot of fuel from a combination of a tight labor market and a friendly NLRB under Biden. Trump has ended that version of the NLRB, and the labor market is beginning to show some signs of slack. So how can they cope with these challenges in the coming months?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say that we already have seen that this model is extremely relevant and important under Trump, because the federal workers across the country have been organizing with precisely this type of worker-to-worker campaign structure. So you see that sometimes the boss is the best organizer, as they say. You've actually had over 14,000 workers have joined federal unions just in the last 5 weeks. This is more than all of federal workers joined in the year prior. So we see that even in response to sort of in defensive battles against Trump, this model is urgently necessary. In the private sector, we've also seen that the organizing has continued. I work with EWOC, Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, and the number of leads we've had has never been higher. Ever since Trump got elected, we were getting inundated with requests of workers to start organizing because they have a sense that it's chaos in the world. The billionaires are in charge, and unless we start organizing, no one is going to save us from above. Certainly the Democrats aren't going to. And you pose a real question, though, which is, if the labor market continues to slacken and if the legal regime continues to be even more unfavorable than it's been, because even under Biden, it was positive because there was a good NLRB. But frankly, the power of the NLRB, even at its best, is still pretty constrained. These are real challenges. I don't think we should underestimate the difficulties of organizing under Trump. I think that at this moment, the most urgent thing will be to beat back the worst of Trump's attacks. And that is a distinct question from unionizing the entire private sector. But if you're able to beat back Trump's attacks, and if you're able to keep back up the momentum at Starbucks, at Amazon, and auto, I think that you're going to continue the overall momentum of labor over the coming months and years.
What you mentioned, the way the federal workers are fighting back, I think that's underappreciated. They've been pretty effective.
Yeah, I've been really depressed about the state of the world, like so many other people, over the last year, you know, from Palestine to Trump. But I've just been, frankly, this is the happiest and most hopeful I've been over the last few weeks, because federal workers are, I think they can win. Musk is just having this wrecking ball operation, but it's very unpopular. The federal workers provide essential services. All of the polls are going against Trump and Musk. And the federal workers, I think, are in a position now where if they continue to do their organizing, continue to bring in the community, we're going to see them win. I think we're going to see them create such a backlash against Musk that Trump is going to throw them to the wolves. And we'll have our first major sort of setback for the Trump administration. It's going to require a lot more organizing. And I would just say, for any listeners out there who want to figure out how they can get involved, there's a lot of actions being planned over the coming days and weeks. So you can go to the following website, go.savepublicservices.com, go.savepublicservices.com. Sign up to find out how you can support the local federal workers fighting back in your area.
Finally, are there lessons here for other movements? You know, a lot of social movements have been NGO-ized and not necessarily productively. So like tenant organizing, environmental justice, these sorts of movements, is there something they can learn from this?
Yeah, part of the argument in my book is that this type of model points a way forward for all social movements, because the essential impasse of social movements in the U.S. and abroad has been that on the one hand, you have actions that are very wide but thin. So Think about how many protests you've been to in which there's no follow-up. It's a one-off mobilization. Everyone goes home afterwards, or like an online petition that doesn't go anywhere. So you have a lot of these sort of very widespread but very thin actions. And on the other hand, you have a lot of very small, sometimes powerful, sometimes not powerful, but you have small initiatives, a lot of nonprofits doing just their local work, getting foundation funding, and have no possibility of scaling up power to take on the billionaire class. And, you know, they're just sort of content to have their little corner of the world. And what we need essentially in all of our different movements is finding ways to scale up power through membership organizations again. So it's not just unions that need a revival of membership organizations. We need that across the board. There's the reason the civil rights movement was a movement, the anti-war movement in the 1960s was a movement. It wasn't just one-off protests. It's because people had mechanisms for continuing to stay involved in between the protests because there was organizations they could join. And so I do think that bringing back the democratic membership base and moving away from the nonprofit model is urgently necessary, you know, whether it's in labor or beyond.
That was Eric Blank, author of We Are the Union, just out from the University of California Press. That website Eric mentioned for following and participating in the Federal Worker Fight Back is go.savepublicservices.com. That's go.savepublicservices.com. And if you're interested in forming a union at your workplace, check out an organization Eric works with, the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, on the web at workerorganizing.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Le Profit, new from friend of Behind the News, Berksonist. Next, the German elections. Germany held elections for its parliament, the Bundestag, on February 23rd. The previous coalition government, led by Olaf Scholz of the Social Democrats, was deeply unpopular, and their vote share fell by over 9 percentage points from the previous election. The top vote-getter was the center-right Christian Democratic Party, led by Friedrich Merz. Second place went to Alternative für Deutschland, Alternative for Germany, known by its German initials AfD. The party is discreet about its ties to neo-Nazis and other far-right tendencies, but they're all over it, which has something to do with why apartheid nostalgist Elon Musk endorsed them. A surprise was the comeback of Die Linke, which translates as the left, a party that traces its roots to the East German Communist Party. Given up for dead, it made a stunning comeback in recent weeks, under the leadership of Heidi Reichenich. Meanwhile, the party of Sarah Wagenknecht, who named it after herself, flopped, coming in 3/100ths of a percentage point short of meeting the 5% threshold for representation in the Bundestag. Wagenknecht had split off from Die Linke and pandered to anti-migrant and anti-trans sentiments, something Die Linke was strenuously opposed to. As we'll hear, much of AfD's vote came from a backlash against immigration, a backlash that was intensified by several high-profile murderous rampages. Alternative is explicitly xenophobic, and the center-rightists of the Christian Democratic Party adopted a lot of their rhetoric. Few voices outside of Die Linke offered any principled defense of migrants as human beings. Yes, the incidents were awful, but almost all the migrants are refugees from conflicts and disruption created by imperial meddling. We see similar things in the U.S., where most of the migrants that outrage Trump and his softer imitators come from countries where our imperial evil-doing, war, sanctions, and the like, has destabilized their societies. But it's a lot easier to blame them than us. We discussed the so-called debt break. The German word is Schuldenbremse. A fun fact about German, Schuld means both debt and guilt. This is a clause in the German Constitution that limits the government's deficit to a very tiny 0.35% of GDP. Here with more is Molly O'Neill, who spent many years in the Foreign Service and who is now a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute. Molly O'Neill. What, if anything, from these election results surprised you?
Well, really nothing. I know that isn't a very interesting reply, but the fact of the matter is the polling in Germany that I follow regularly, because that's what I'm going to be writing about and what I'm interested in, it's very, very accurate. So there was really no surprise whatsoever in it. And yet it's a shock to the system for most of the world, because I think the strong performance of the Alternative für Deutschland, AfD, thought of in Germany as untouchable, because to the right of the center-right party, which was the victor in the elections, that's the Christian Democrat Party. I wrote something for Quincy, and I called it predictable but momentous. So it a huge change, but not anything that was really unexpected either.
Okay, why did people vote for AfD? Do you understand that?
Yeah, well, it's a complex thing, I think. There's probably their trademark, if you want to call it that, issue is the migration issue. And as you will remember, in 2015, Angela Merkel, in the heart of the refugee crisis, where people were arriving from Afghanistan and Syria principally, she welcomed them and rolled, and I won't say, you know, not so much that she would have tried to urge them to come, but she accepted the obligation, as she saw it, of Germany to protect people fleeing from conflict and persecution. So she welcomed them in that sense, and so did many Germans at the time. But, you know, it's a little realized fact that there's been a continuing inflow since, not more, but, you know, still probably not a great deal less than in that event in 2015. And it so happens that during the election period, there were three really pretty awful events, mass casualty events that were carried out by people from the Middle East, having their origins in the Middle East. Different ones were for different reasons, but it created such a shock. I mean, there was a person, a Saudi national, who had resided and been a doctor in the, a psychiatrist, believe it or not, in Germany for some years. He drove his car into a whole crowd of people in the Magdeburg Christmas market. Magdeburg is a city south of Berlin. And then not long after that, there was in Bavaria a young man who had been refused asylum, who clearly was mentally ill, and he stabbed some children and killed one of these children, and then killed a bystander who attempted to intervene to stop the murder. And then most recently in Munich, someone, also Afghan of origin, I believe, drove into a crowd in Munich right before the Munich Security Conference. So there is a very high level of anxiety in the country that the failure to deport people who didn't even qualify for asylum has created these kind of conditions. So that was one of the main reasons. Probably the economy is another reason. If you look at the actual profile of the vote, you can see that people who, it's kind of like in the U.S. where the Republican Party now gets more votes from the less educated or not higher educated, no higher education kind of cohort, and the Democrats from the people who have had higher education. So that those statistics are exactly parallel in Germany. In other words, AfD is getting the working class vote, especially in places where employment, well, there's a process of deindustrialization, there's a lot of stress going on in a lot of the principal industries. So that was a reason. And maybe the AfD is opposed to the war in Ukraine, so that could also be an issue, although I don't really think that was a primary issue in the decision-making of most voters.
Has the vote for AfD spread into the West? It used to be pretty concentrated in the East, right? Is it spreading westward?
Germans love to tell themselves that it's because people in the East are ignoramuses or something like that. I have no idea. But anyway, no, it is. It's not the case. But if you look at, like, which party came first in each precinct, I guess we'd call it. So there are some really neat maps. You can look them up. So you'll see that when former East, AfD finished first in virtually all of the former East, except for like Berlin, where the left-wing party was first, and also Leipzig, which is kind of a, you know, a youthful city, the Linke, that's the left party, they finished first. If you look at the western part and the southern part of Germany, definitely the CDU, that's the center right, and their partner down in Bavaria, which is called CSU. They're linked together. Virtually, they're the same party. Anyway, they had a first place finish in very much of those other regions. So there is a general picture like that. For the first time, though, AfD won a couple of elections precincts in the West. So, and I think if you look carefully under the hood, you'll probably see they came a close second in a lot of others.
Now, the Social Democrats were humiliated. What did they do wrong to earn this kind of rebuke?
It wasn't just them. There were the three parties in the coalition, the so-called Ampel, which means traffic lights. So their colors are red, yellow, and green. It's true that SPD had the chancellorship, and I'm afraid some of it has to do with the leadership style of Olaf Scholz. I actually don't mind him. I think he's a very intelligent man and so on, but he isn't really particularly good at kind of the pithy soundbite. He doesn't really know how to sell or win support, or really to explain himself very well. So there was that. The three-party coalition, that had never been tried before, and they were so quarrelsome and all that, so they got tied up in knots, and eventually their weakest partner, which was the Free Democrat, headed by the finance minister, who was a real fiscal hawk, he insisted that they needed to cut spending and they needed to cut some programs, especially in the green transition, and so he was fighting with the Greens, who were also in the coalition. So it just ended in acrimony, and like, I guess it started in the middle of November. So I think the whole public just felt that they were just ineffectual. So all three of them really were punished. The FDP, that's the Free Democrats, they didn't even pass the 5% threshold, so they'll have no seats in the new Bundestag.
What role does the Green Party play in German politics, ideologically and demographically?
Well, initially they were kind of a challenge to the SPD. I think most of their voters in the good old days back in the, was it in the 80s that they first arose? And they were also very oriented toward peace. So their anti-nuclear stance was also an anti-war stance in those days. But they've evolved quite a bit, and now they're really a more kind of like a liberal hawks in a way. I mean, they're very big on the war in Ukraine and the moral case for defense of Ukraine and the necessity of beating or of forcing a defeat on Russia. And so that's part of their program. But also on the green side of things, which is their core, they are, of course, against nuclear power. And actually, Merkel, in order to ingratiate herself with them, as she had eliminated or ordered the closure of all the nuclear power plants. So the Greens had the foreign ministry, as everybody knows, Annalena Baerbock, who was very hawkish on Ukraine. But they also had the economy minister, Robert Habeck, who led the effort to really accelerate the use of alternative energy. And that really fell at a bad time, because with the economy dropping into recession, those issues, I'm afraid, just began to take a back seat to just bread and butter issues like affording one's life, you know what I mean? And so I think a lot of people felt that those kind of measures were a luxury they couldn't afford. So that's why they lost. They fell to 11.5%. That was down a few percentages. But previously they had commanded a lot of support among younger people. I think in the most recent election in 2021, they're younger, highly educated people, urban people, and not all young, also older, like people like you or me. But I think maybe their moment is past. Maybe they'll come back, but definitely they're declining.
Now, there is a lot of talk about the German economy being in very substantial structural decline, not just a cyclical thing, but something more serious than that. First of all, do you agree with that? And second of all, what role did that play, if any, in this campaign?
It played a huge role. That's why the AfD posed as a really kind of confronting the green phenomenon is not really for real people, not really for the heartland, and not for vulnerable people or people with low income. And inflation, of course, just as in the American election, that, you know, for Germans, you probably know that inflation is, it induces almost like trauma in a lot of Germans anyway, because of what happened in the latter phase of the 20s hyperinflation. That explains a large reason why the Germans are typically disposed to being very, very careful stewards of the fiscal a situation and not overspending and not becoming indebted and all that sort of thing. So inflation mattered a lot. So I think the people with low incomes, in fact, I saw there was some polling. I saw there's a historian called Katja Hoyer, who's a professor and works in the UK. She's from the East herself. She showed today some polling that people who thought that they could barely afford their daily expenditures and feared that they were going to go under as a result, those were principally voting for AFD.
I'm speaking with Molly O'Neill, a fellow at the Quincy Institute. And then the left party, Die Linke, were widely assumed to be near death just a few months ago. And they had to recall a quote from the Richard Nixon era, the greatest political comeback since Lazarus. What what happened that caused this sudden surge out of nowhere?
I've been wondering, too, because I had been watching what was going on with the competing. The breakaway from Die Linke is the Bündnisse Wagenknecht. And you may know that they had a heartbreaking result. They came out with 4.97% of the vote, and that means they have no seats. And whereas Die Linke, the party that Sarah Wagenknecht had abandoned because she is so dynamic and she thought they were all hopeless or something. Anyway, they came back. Now, why? Apparently, there's a young woman who was their leader who I had never even heard of before. She was a really effective leader, apparently also had some very good use of TikTok. And what was the issue that I think made the difference for them was migration again. Because a while back, maybe a couple months ago, during the course of the campaign, I think Friedrich Merz, the head of the CDU, decided that migration was taking votes from CDU and giving them to AfD. So he decided to take a stand about migration as well in the aftermath of these events I told you about. So he put forward a resolution, even though he wasn't in the government, but as part of the delegation of the CDU in the parliament, he put forward a resolution calling for much sterner measures, early deportation, careful vetting of the arrivals, and so on, measures like that. And he put it forward for a vote, and it won a majority, and he knew it would, but the majority depended upon AfD. AfD voted for it. And he said, it doesn't matter if something's right, I don't care who votes for it, I'm going to just take that as a victory. Well, this didn't turn out to be a well-conceived measure because it provoked like an enormous number of demonstrations across all the big cities in Germany saying, no, never, never again, we don't want the extreme right. And Merz, his posters were defaced with a Hitler mustache and everything else. I thought that was going to hurt them in the election, but it didn't hurt them in any evident way. They still came out with their nearly 30% of the vote, which is still not a very particularly impressive result when you think about the history of that party and the years they spent governing. Die Linke is very, very doctrinally anti-right-wing and anti-fascist. And so they came out and said, no, never, 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 never. And they were among the people who were leading those demonstrations, and I think also on their TikTok campaign. So I think they generated enthusiasm from people who didn't like the fact that Sarah Wagenknecht had adopted a more, what she thought was a pragmatic and astute kind of policy of recognizing that some of the lower income people in Germany were really troubled by immigration, what they saw as some of the dangers, security dangers, and so on and so forth. And so she tried to align with them, at least to some extent, to take on board that there needed to be measures to reform immigration, and I think that hurt her, and I think it helped Die Linke. So it shows that there's a store of people on the left in Germany who really don't want to make any compromises with this never again stance and are really concerned and haunted by the danger that they see AfD may pose.
And now the likely incoming chancellor, although it's not going to be a simple matter to form a government, is it? But the likely incoming chancellor, Friedrich Merz, said something about a divorce between the U.S. and Europe. What do you make of that? What's that going to look like? Is this all emerging from the Vance speech, or are there things leading up to that that also are at play?
Well, the Vance speech and then Trump's decision to open negotiations with the Russians that completely, and to exclude the Europeans from having input into anything like that. And so, as you see, we have Macron, and now we're going to have Starmer coming to the U.S. to plead with them to not do that. not to just in the minds of the Europeans that are so convinced of the case that's been made for intervention in Ukraine. I think they feel that Ukraine is being sold out and they just can't bring themselves to, I don't know. I at the moment, they're in a state of shock about it, at least, and they're really resisting hard the steps that Trump has taken. But before I go there, I'll just tell you that I don't think it will be that hard to form a government. It's quite clear, luckily, because neither Sara Wagenknecht's party nor the FDP got seats. The way it works is those that didn't get seats, those votes are distributed among those parties that did pass the threshold. I mean, this is obviously kind of a technical thing, but it means that between them, Meretz's party and Scholz's party, the SPD, have got 52% of the seats. So it will only be those two parties, and they've governed together for most of Merkel's time in chancellorship. So I don't think it is that hard, especially with Meretz being so dominant relative to Scholz. So actually, Scholz is withdrawing from that leadership. He's named this much younger guy called Lars Klingbeil to take over the head the negotiation. So I don't think there'll be that much difficulty to form a government. And they do share in general this same idea that the shock at what Vance said, upset about what Trump is doing, and concern about Europe being sidelined and becoming marginalized. So the reaction that they're taking is to vow that at last Europe will raise their defense capabilities by pouring money into defense spending to bring about a situation where in the final emergency or in some sort of emergency, they could offer a meaningful defense, at least conventional defense against Russia, should Russia become more aggressive subsequent to the, after the Ukraine war ends. So that's going to be the big issue, is how much money can the spending would be added to the defense budget. That's what their first reflex is going to be. And, to be honest, maybe that's a healthy reflex in the sense that they have for so long sheltered under this belief that the U.S. is they're sort of outsourcing their defense or their security to the United States. And this has obviously been a very rude awakening, these developments.
And the debt brake, which has inhibited German fiscal policy for a long time, is that going to go?
Yes. Well, I think probably it will. It's because both Meretz has now come on board that it needs to be reformed. I'm not clear exactly what that means. And already Scholz was in favor of that. But you've got to have a 2/3 vote because it's constitutional. And it turns out that in the elections we just had, you have 1/3 of the vote is with the combination of AfD and Linke together is slightly more than 1/3. And AfD opposes changing the debt brake. Their stance on fiscal policy is somewhat similar to that of, the mainstream in the old days. I mean, CDU also used to be very opposed to ending a debt brake. So that's the AfD stance, and I think they will stick to it. The question is about Linke. Linke also doesn't favor rearmament, but would favor relaxation of the debt brake if it was for, like, the domestic infrastructure issues like the rail and roads and other kind of infrastructure that's been neglected. And it's hard to imagine, but it's the case that Germans now feel that their rail isn't efficient as it was, and all this other kind of public investment. It really is a need. So I think Die Linke would go for relaxing the debt brake, but I read today that Meretz is talking about doing it exclusively for defense expenditure, and I don't think that will fly with Die Linke. So I'm wondering whether they'll be able to relieve the constraint of this debt brake.
And finally, can we look forward to the militarization of Europe?
Well, yeah, I think so. But as I'm not myself a hawkish person, but I do think that there's something anomalous about these very rich countries that have a high standard of living relying exclusively upon the United States for even the conventional part of their defense. I could understand for the nuclear umbrella, but I think it's really high time that they made some changes like this. But, of course, the thing is, you've got some states like France, which has always been relatively an advocate, really, of the so-called strategic autonomy for Europe. So that's been an idea that French have long held. It kind of descends from de Gaulle. But, you know, their fiscal situation is such that I don't know how they come up with any money. And they are already, the deficit to GDP is something like 5 or maybe even 6%. And they're, as you've seen, their politics are just completely riven by these big polarized kind of left and right kind of dynamic. So I don't see France as being in a position to raise their defense expenditure. And there may be other countries that are in pretty much the same situation. But Germany isn't. They've got relatively low debt and a small public deficit is reasonable. They've been prudent up until now. So I think they have some scope to make some expansion.
The idea that Wehrmacht in the march again is a little nervous-making, though.
Well, I know it's scary. I know that all of us, including people in Europe, have that feeling. So that people have a mixed reaction to it. But, you know, Poland is already spending close to 5% of their GDP on defense. And so I think Germany could add at least something. But, no, I do agree that it all should be done with a kind of a it's very important to try to restore the role of the EU, and I'm very concerned that, you know, I perceive that the our administration is really has virtually no time for the EU at all. I mean, they do their best to seemingly deal exclusively with the member countries. It's just a traditional form of diplomacy. And also, of course, the trade dispute between the U.S. is mainly focused on the European side. The EU has responsibility for trade policy. Merz is a very strong pro-European, so I feel that he will try to frame everything in a European context. Ideally, he would like to restore the tandem, as they call it, between France and Germany. I think that's laudable. I think it's a good idea, but it's just, it's difficult now because one doesn't know how long Macron is going to remain relevant and what may happen after he leaves office in 2027.
That was Molly O'Neill, a former Foreign Service officer who is now a fellow at the Quincy Institute. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of Nico's rendition of the German national anthem. Till next week. Bye.